Welcome to the IF Podcast. I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation, and today the topic is urban education. Today we have three guests who can give us some on-the-ground perspective. Julie Sweetland is the founding director of the Urban Teacher Academy at the University of the District of Columbia. She's a Stanford-trained linguist who has also been a teacher and trainer of teachers for the past decade. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we have Derek Andrews, a high school guidance counselor at an alternative high school in Washington, D.C. He's a graduate of the University of Maryland and George Washington University. Welcome, Derek.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, we have Darla Bunting, a third grade literacy teacher in Washington, D.C. She's an alumnus of the University of Maryland and Teach for America, and her Twitter stream gives raw, unfiltered, and rare inside view of the challenges and successes in her urban classroom. Welcome, Darla.
Thank you for having me.
Recently in the headlines, we had the GOP presidential frontrunner Rick Santorum making headlines again when on the campaign trail in Ohio, he called public schools quote-unquote factories.
The idea that the federal government should be running schools, frankly, much less that the state government should be running schools, is anachronistic. It goes back to the time of industrialization of America when people came off the farms where they did homeschool. Or have the little neighborhood school, and into these big factories, so we built equal factories called public schools. And while those factories, as we all know in Ohio and Pennsylvania, have fundamentally changed, the factory school has not.
Okay, so quick fact check, the federal government doesn't actually operate schools, and, you know, as most of us know, most U.S. schools are supported primarily by state and local funding or a combination of the two. But I bring up this comment because I wanted to see from you all whether you believe there's any truth to what he's saying.
I find it rare that I would agree with a conservative candidate, but I think there's actually something to what he's saying. The building plan of many of the public schools that we have today, they're actually not based on the factory architecture. They're based on prison architecture. And so it's symbolic of the intentions of the public schools, you know, when they did really become popular after the Industrial Revolution. It really was to train factory workers with a minimal amount of skills to be able to read, write, and follow directions well enough to be able to operate major machinery, and kind of that was it. And so to the extent that we still have that mindset, I agree that our public schools are anachronistic. That's certainly not every public school, and there's a lot of hope and ability to move forward, but I think there's something to what he's saying.
Darla, you were going to add something?
In my experience teaching in New Orleans and now teaching in the District of Columbia, I do see that many schools are kind of educating students with a one-size-fits-all approach. There's not much differentiation. And our students, they need multiple ways to engage in the material. And I feel as though to best prepare students to be competitive, not only in America, but in the global landscape, we need to make sure that we're best preparing students in multiple ways that don't kind of push them to fit into a sort of cookie cutter mold, but that helps to increase their passion.
I think it's time for us to have a rational discussion about public education in America. So I think it's worth sort of probing a little more and see, like, how do we make these changes? How do these changes come about? We understand what the challenges are, but how do we really effectively change things? I think that's the challenge that we're all faced with.
Right. I mean, what are some of the ideas that you all see in having us make that shift? Because, you know, one of the other things that have changed since those factory days is that students, even, you know, your elementary students, they can retrieve more information on a smartphone or an iPod than is in anybody's mind or, you know, 10,000 libraries. So how do we prepare those kids to be able to operate in this environment?
Well, I think the question of how to prepare 21st century learners is a really interesting one. And to some extent, we don't have all the research that we need to do that. But to answer the bigger question or to start to open it up, I think it has to be about the role of the teacher. That's what needs to shift. There are so few jobs in America that look exactly the same today as they did in 1812 or even 1912. And teaching pretty much looks the same. If you pull up an old black and white photograph of a school teacher in front of a group of kids, she has on maybe a long dress, and, you know, the hairstyles and the clothes are different, but the actual setup of what you're looking at when you walk into a classroom is pretty much the same. And so to be able to shift in our own teacher attracting systems, our ways of preparing them, our ways of organizing their school days, all those sorts of things. Like, that to me is the key leverage point of what is a teacher doing, and just shifting them from being a dispenser of knowledge and really a provider of daily instruction to something that's more about facilitating children finding their own ways through this rich information world that we have.
Let's offer schools a deal. Give them the resources to keep good teachers on the job and reward the best ones. And in return, grant schools flexibility to teach with creativity and passion, to stop teaching to the test, and to replace teachers who just aren't helping kids learn.
Now, Darla, are you able to make that shift to becoming a facilitator as opposed to somebody dispensing knowledge?
I know personally, I kind of battle with, you know, should I be able to teach this? Or like, I have to feel the brunt of what my principal says or what my dean of curriculum and instruction may say if I choose to teach a certain subject in a way that does not best prepare my students for like the multiple choice bubble and test. Teachers are working within a framework that they don't have a lot of voice, they don't have a lot of input in, and are really shunned from doing anything outside of that current structure.
President Obama brought up this issue of teaching to the test in a State of the Union. But when your job is relying on that, and your evaluations are hindered on that, and your future career and livelihood is, does the principal even have to have a conversation with you about it? Because at the end of the day, that's how you're going to be judged.
Principals also, like, they have the pressure on them to deliver certain results. So a lot of principals are buckling to the pressure of their school meeting AYP and other measures. And so because there's so much pressure put on them, they then put that pressure on the teacher. And I feel as though it's really crippling schools. It's really crippling our students, and it's not enabling them to reach their full potential because I'm delivering information, but they don't have much time to discuss it. They are not thinking as critically about it because the way in which that I have to normally assess them is through the multiple choice way, so that they're used to taking these multiple choice exams by the time they have to take the test.
When you are in the classroom, I can't even picture that, how a multiple choice assessment would come into reading a book.
So right now we have Reader's Workshop, and basically through Reader's Workshop, we're teaching like the habits of good readers and how to analyze a text. And what my professional learning community, as in like the other third through fifth grade literacy teachers, what we try to do is we try to create learning that is very organic, but at the end of the day, like, we always have to have some sort of concrete assessment that best prepares them for the test. I know recently in January, a lot of schools have talks with their teachers about creating unit assessments that mirror the format of the test. We're teaching them how to read. We're teaching them how to have a love of reading, but we have to also expose them to the way in which they're going to be tested.
So it's every day?
Every day I have to give an exit ticket, which is normally in the format of a multiple choice assessment.
Julie, I mean, you're training urban teachers to go into this environment. I mean, how do you prepare them for that?
I don't take Darla to mean that assessment is a bad thing in and of itself. Mm-hmm. It's when we get hyper-focused on one particular type of assessment and kind of everything else. If it doesn't get assessed, then it doesn't get valued. And so therefore, the things that we're not assessing get devalued. And of course, although I'm deeply dissatisfied with the way we assess right now, in some ways, I think it's better than what came before, okay? Because before we had No Child Left Behind, there was this long and hidden inequity within our public school system where lots of students were not being well served. And these were students who were from poor working class and communities of color. They weren't being well served, and no one was talking about it at all. So I wasn't okay with that. Now, I'm not okay with what we're doing now, which is now we're shining this hyper bright light on these communities that aren't being well served. And that's the only thing we're looking at, is whether or not they're doing the very basics. So that's not the right answer either. But at least we're attending to who's getting an educational experience that meets our minimum standards and who isn't. So to me, that's some progress. It's slow, and it certainly, we have way, long way to go. So we talked to our teachers about the big context of assessment, that schools are institutions and institutions have certain goals, and you need to match up your goal for why you're in this profession, which for many of the teachers that, you know, we're called the Urban Teacher Academy. So these are teachers who want to work in high need schools. You know, your goal is to push these children beyond their perceived limits. And the ultimate goal of these assessments, even though I don't think that they're making great progress, that's what these people's intention is too, the people who are, you know, increasing the pressure on the test. So one thing is we help them see the common cause. And so hopefully that can kind of ratchet down their anxiety and open up their curiosity and their creativity for different ways to do it. To come down and tell teachers, you know, like Darla, that it must be an exit ticket. That's your only way you can assess at the end of a lesson. It has to be a multiple choice question, and it has to be a multiple choice question on one of the standards that we think are going to be on the end of your test. That's when you've just gone too far, right? You've taken something that is a good idea, it has a good intention, and you've just deformed it to the point of ridiculousness, you know? And then what that does, that takes a creative teacher, and it totally demotivates them. You know, who wants to do things that they don't really believe in just because someone told them to do it every day and do it for not a lot of pay and do it in a room with children all day where you can't, you know, go get a cup of coffee or use the restroom? Like, you know, you start to go down this very slippery slope of, so why am I doing this? Again, I don't know if I answered your question as to what we do, but part of what we do is we talk about why that is. Like, why is my principal, who for all other indicator seems to be a rational human being, why is he or she telling me to do this really ridiculous, repetitive thing?
We also know that when students don't walk away from their education, more of them walk the stage to get their diploma. So tonight, I am proposing that every state requires that all students stay in high school until they graduate or turn 18.
So, Derek, you are, again, you're a counselor at an alternative high school. Could you just talk a little bit about your school's approach to this problem?
From my perspective, you know, working in a school in Ward 7, east of the river, where most of our students come from pretty challenging backgrounds, right? A lot of our kids who come to us are, you know, two or three grade levels behind, and they're in high school. So you could have a kid who's 18 in the ninth grade or, you know, 19 in the 10th grade. And how do these things impact the way a student learns, right? That's kind of one of the challenges that we deal with. And then also, what other challenges are students facing outside of school in the community? For example, you know, violence, high unemployment rates, all these challenges, while at the same time you're trying to get a kid to be engaged in school, to matriculate, to graduate, it's very challenging. There's no one way of doing this. You pretty much, you know, every kid is different. You know, going back to what Julia and Darla outlined, you know, in terms of, okay, here's the goal in the school. You know, we have to meet AYP. We have to, you know, make sure the kids are learning, make sure they're engaged. But at the same time, we're talking about, you know, child development. Like, how are these kids being developed outside of the school and what challenges are they facing? So when a kid comes into the school, but a kid may, you know, be having some grief and loss issue, or, you know, they may just been evicted. So that's going to impact how the kid receives the lesson in the class. So that's kind of where I come in. Like, I'm not in the classroom, but I'm more so working with students who are facing these challenges outside the school. And then when they come to school, they're not fully engaged. So then you see how complicated this whole thing is of keeping kids, you know, on track towards graduation. It's a situation where it's a case-by-case issue that we all deal with. I don't know what the answer is. I do know what the challenges are. And in having these challenges, if we address them, you know, effectively, I think, you know, it helps for some kids. It builds up, you know, a high level of resiliency. You know what I mean? So kids can bounce back despite having these challenges and do well and move on. And everything that we've said so far is pretty much true. You know, we're sort of using an outdated model in outdated, you know, buildings to teach kids, in, you know, who've been distracted since birth, you know, how to focus on a dry erase board and compete in the 21st century.
You bring up that word distraction, and that's actually one of the things that I wanted to bring up today. You know, everybody knows that, like, our kids right now are very distracted. They have a lot of media input coming from many different directions all the time. And so they're really dealing with a lot of information overload. But there was a really wonderful essay in the New York Times that I just read. It was by a playwright named Hanif Qureshi, and the title was The Art of Distraction. You know, he was sort of talking about his son and how who was so sort of off, you know, one of these kids that are really distracted and was not reading and doing math on grade level. And so those tickets were not were not good for this kid, and he ended up getting this label. I just want to read a little bit from it because it's, you know, I thought it was really thoughtful. And he says, "Can the ability to do a particular thing be described as a quote unquote condition at all? Would the fact that I can't do the tango, read music, or speak Russian be considered a condition? Is it a failure of my development? Am I ill?" And it usually isn't long with experts before they begin to talk fashionably about brains and chemicals. Biological determinism is one of psychology's ugliest evasions, removing the poetic human from any issue. An appeal to the pseudo-certainties of science might seem finally to settle any question, but this is a moral issue rather than a scientific one. Values are at stake here, not facts. It is the attempted standardization of a human being. And he goes on and on to sort of wax poetic around this issue. You know, are you seeing the opportunity for creativity to thrive in your schools and classrooms?
I feel as though the creativity of our students, it has been limited. My school in particular, we have music education, we have arts education, and we have physical education. But all three of those teachers, they're not receiving quality resources in order to really get the students engaged in artwork or in music and physical education. In our art classes, we see a lot of just simple, you know, crayons on paper and painting on paper, but it's done in a very simplistic format. There's not much depth. I believe it's because a lot of other things are prioritized instead of a lot of the focus really is on the tested subjects and a lot of other subjects, even outside of the arts, social studies, science. They're just not high priorities for schools. And I feel as though it really puts our students at a disadvantage because a lot of children stay in school because of their passion. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of students who are into sports. Even if they're falling behind, they love football. So they're going to stay in school so that they can keep playing football or baseball or running track. And I feel as though we have to create more opportunities to allow students to develop their passions, because once you figure out what your passion is, it motivates you. So schools definitely need to give students outlets to express themselves creatively, because it is something that helps motivate them to want to learn more, to want to develop themselves.
One of the things you always think about, okay, well, it's art class now. Now it's time for you to be creative, right? But I mean, like, is there any room for creativity in science, in reading, in math?
I think the essayist that you were citing, I mean, that's part of what the essayist was getting at, that it's this narrow definition of achievement that kind of cuts off all these other areas of human intelligence. To me, it's school. It's not just school today, but it's the process of how we think about schooling that cuts it off. There's some research that shows that when children come in kindergarten on this one measure, the Torrance test of creativity, it's a standardized test of creativity, if you can believe that, but it's used often to assess children for gifted and talented schools. At kindergarten, all children are geniuses. They're all gifted and talented, according to this test. And as you test on and on and on, you see this real depression of the creative ability, right? The ability to make novel connections, to think of one thing and have that spark in your mind, 1700 different little connections of things that you've thought of before, facts and ideas and possibilities and questions. And those sorts of connections, that sort of creativity, that can happen in every subject. It's not the way we think of subjects in school. So for instance, what we do in school in mathematics is typically learning to follow the paths of very specific procedures that were worked out by someone else decades or even centuries ago. But what mathematicians do, they are treading paths that no one has figured out. They've gotten partway down the path, but there's this unanswered question. There's something, there's a problem that there's not a full resolution to yet. And that's what mathematicians spend their days doing. And that's very creative, and it's collaborative. Those mathematicians are texting or tweeting or talking or meeting with other mathematicians all the time. They're trying a million different ways, and half of them, you know, most of them don't work until they get this one answer. And that's almost a radical opposite of the way we teach math in school. So I don't think that every single moment of math instruction right now should be that, because we don't need children to necessarily spend their entire first 3 years of school rediscovering how to add.
Well, Julie was mentioning about, you know, the creativity test that was given to kindergartners where they scored, you know, at the genius level, and we pretty much educate the creativity out of them as they, you know, matriculate through school. It's a tough situation that we're in. Again, I don't know what the answers are, but I do know that, you know, we have to be better and do better to sort of make sure that all these kids have a fighting chance once they're out of school.
You know, I want to go back to the question that, you know, we began the podcast with. Is urban any different than suburban or rural education? You know, one of the things that I think, going back to what Santorum's comments were, is there's sort of a movement of thought around education in this country that sort of regards it as welfare or an extension of the welfare system.
In school systems, whether they be urban or rural, but in school systems where you have high concentrations of children who are growing up in poverty, or even just in low levels of want, then we hyper-focus on giving them the quote-unquote basics. And anything else seems like a nice extra. So Michelle Rhee was famously quoted as, I don't care if they're creative, don't give me that crap if they can't read and write, right? So that, you know, for these children, it's considered, you know, not even just a nice extra, but completely, you know, ridiculous that they should even need this in advance of the basics. And that's not what the case for more affluent children. The parents of more affluent children don't stand for, you know, a very dry, rigid, and narrow curriculum. But I do think that teachers knowing that and going into school contexts that are, as the two practitioners that, you know, are on the panel here, you know, described as challenging and squelching and difficult, the teachers that are going into that context mindfully, they need the same core of being able to do really active and creative instruction. But I think that they need three extra things. And one is the ability to accelerate children's learning, to just kind of know, right, the odds are the kids in my class are going to be 2 to 3 grade levels behind. I'm not going to moan about that. I have some actual strategies to catch them up as best as I can and get them a little further ahead than you might think they'd be able to. Two, they have to be able to thrive in really challenging work conditions. The sad fact is that many of our schools, you know, that are in urban settings, you're likely to encounter hostility in the workplace, not necessarily from the parents, but probably from your colleagues. You're not going to have enough physical resources. You're not going to have enough scissors, enough books, those sorts of things to go around. So you need to be able to really be a self-motivator and kind of bring your own joy with you and your own creativity to get stuff and not let that wear you down. And then I think the third thing the great urban teacher comes with is a sense that they can create change in their classroom and beyond their classroom.
And that's Darla, totally. You know, that's why I'm such a huge fan of her Twitter feed, is that you understand that these are very difficult situations, you know, poverty, and there's all these challenges, but you still are sort of seeing the joy and learning. She calls them her scholars, you know, which is always wonderful. Oh, my scholars did this. And you know, that's a very subtle thing that I think that probably they absorb and translates, you know. Darla, if you could sort of speak to what Julie is saying. And as an urban teacher, those three modifications that she described, that's coming from you, and you're not necessarily getting paid anymore or getting any more, you know. So what motivates you to do it, and how do you keep from getting burnt out?
I definitely continue to teach for my kids, because at the end of the day, you know, when that light bulb goes off, or when they're, you know, conversing with their friends and they're talking about what you told them in class, or they're talking about how they want to go to college, and it's not something that they're just repeating from you, but it's something that they are having in their own little conversations. And it's in those little moments that you realize why you chose to take a job in an urban school. And I feel as though what I don't want to happen is that so much of the testing pressure cripples so many great teachers. And I don't want it to become a place where They come in and we're so optimistic, and then we just like get crushed by the system. And many teachers go to teach in other places where they feel like more appreciated. And I feel as though one thing that's really, really important is that we don't just simply focus on the teacher, but we focus on creating schools, because teachers are just like one component of the school. And yes, we do need to develop teachers, but the person or the staff that develops the teachers is just as crucial to the teacher in that particular class. Having a principal who is very knowledgeable of the teaching practice and what supports teachers need, and that principal being able to hire a staff that has instructional coaches who really know the craft and able to develop teachers. And I feel as though a lot of times those supports aren't brought into the conversation enough, because it's not just a teacher by themselves. Like, I have a hardworking staff that is there to support me, to observe me, and to offer me feedback to help me develop into a great professional. Because without my colleagues, I wouldn't be able to stay where I am in a turnaround school that's ranked one of the lowest performing in the district with little resources. And we have to make sure that we're creating strong schools, not just strong teachers.
And strong communities, too.
Exactly.
Because it's not, you know, divorced from that. So, Derek, right. I mean, you're part of that village of the school. Like, the PC thing is to say, okay, it's just education, you know. And in fact, that's what you hear from a lot of reformers, including Michelle Rhee, is that they don't sort of take into account these differences in socioeconomic status. And there's nothing different about a classroom, you know, the context doesn't matter.
So I think what makes the urban educational system different, I guess, would be pretty much like the geographical landscape, right? And what I mean by that is the challenges that, you know, that students are facing in terms of what's happening outside the school, what's happening in the community, and having those opportunities to sort of compare where they live with, you know, other parts of the world. For example, we're in Washington, D.C., and some of the students that I serve don't necessarily travel outside of their community. You know, so despite being in an urban setting, you know, there's some challenges, there's some disadvantages, but there are actually probably more positives to being in an urban setting, you know, specifically in Washington, D.C. But the school sort of collaborating with the community, with students, with families to sort of broaden the students' perspective on the world, first of all, to help to, you know, broaden their global view. Like, how do we help a kid who's in an urban setting, who's facing these challenges, to use that as fuel to propel them to achieve phenomenal things? That's sort of how I look at things. When I'm working with a student who, you know, has, you know, whatever challenges they're facing, I'm trying to help them to put a spin on that so that they could use that experience to positively impact, you know, their trajectory. And show them how, you know, everything that they're doing is connected to, you know, the broader world that we live in.
It's a perfect segue to the final thing that I wanted to ask you all, which is, what do you experience in your day that gives you hope for the future? And anyone can jump in on that.
There's so much hope throughout my day. We had a new home visit initiative over the summer, and I really got to, you know, speak with so many of my parents before school even began. So the relationship building got to happen prior to them coming up to the school and meeting me. I actually got to go to their homes. I got to see their neighborhoods. I got to see which kids lived near each other and, you know, how different kids got to school. They're only in third grade, so they don't realize like how the school that they're walking into or like the neighborhoods that they live in, like they don't really understand the social context that they're living in. And it's my like job to help best prepare them for a world that started them out behind. And what gives me hope is that they're so hopeful, even living among such disparity, because they're so youthful. They don't know the context in which they live. And I think it's very crucial that education reformers don't just say like, oh, this school is successful in poverty. And so like, because this school is successful, you know, we can create other successful schools without also thinking about the larger picture in our society and how we can also ensure that successful school isn't an exception, and that we can create better economic opportunities for children living in our country.
Julie, what keeps you motivated and what are you the most hopeful in the work that you're doing?
You know, I really believe in that each one can reach one. And so that keeps me hopeful. And the other thing, or that's what that keeps me motivated, the thing that I find hopeful is that I think that as a society, one of the few things that we really agree on is that education can make a difference and that it's important. And there aren't a whole lot of things that we do agree on. And of course, there are things that we quibble about around the edges. And sometimes we're quibbling really at the core, but this is something we all are invested in to some extent. And so I think that anytime you're putting everyone in a democracy together, worrying about a problem or concerned about a problem, then you're going to end up with a better result than you started out with.
All right. Well, this has been the IF Podcast. I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. Thank you so much for joining me, Derek Andrews, a counselor at an alternative school in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Derek.
Thanks for having me.
And Darla Bunting, a third grade literacy teacher in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Darla.
The pleasure was all mine.
And thank you, Julie Sweetland, the head of the Urban Teacher Academy at the University of District of Columbia. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.